Case number 12-7055, Joseph Farah et al. Appellants v. Esquire Magazine et al. Mr. Klayman for the appellants, Mr. Donnellan for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Judges Rogers, Brown, and Williams, I'm sorry. Honored to be before you. I want to introduce you to our client, Mr. Joseph Farah. He's the publisher of World and Daily Books. And, of course, the other appellant here is Jerome Corsi, a New York Times bestselling author of the book, Where's the Birth Certificate? I want to point out at the outset that the case is not really about whether or not President Obama was born in the United States. That's an issue which is in dispute in our populace. About 25% of the population believes that, others do not. The issue is about the commercial marketability of a book. The ability of someone to come forward, to write what he believes, to have First Amendment rights respected, and to not have that book destroyed by a competitor for whatever reason, who does not want that book to be published. A quotation that we found in Othello by Shakespeare, I think, sums this up. Good name in man and woman is the immediate jewel of their souls. Who steals my purse, steals my trash. But he who that filches me, my good name, robs me of that which enriches him and makes me poor indeed. And that's, in fact, what happened here, is that we had an article that was published in Esquire magazine. And when it was published, it had no disclaimer. It didn't have any statement that it was satire. It was starkly real in what was said. And in that statement, and it's contained in our briefs and elsewhere in the record, it states that Joseph Farah, it actually quotes him, the publisher, saying that this book's inaccurate because the birth certificate of the president had just been published on the website, that it was going to be pulled from shelves, that it was an embarrassment, that he was going to rip Mr. Corsi a new one, actual quotations. And the whole effect of that was to get booksellers and purchasers to call and say, hey, I'm canceling my orders. I'm not going to take this book. I want my money back. That was commercial. That was a competitor.
The briefs have interesting, and it seemed to me slightly conflicting, observations about how you identify satire. And on the one hand, there's the sort of general legal idea that something is satire, at least in this context, where the reasonable reader would not believe it to be an assertion of fact. On the other hand, there seem to be indications in the briefs that for some of the most famous satires in the world, a lot of people didn't get it originally. Swift's famous satire on cannibalism in Ireland. How are we supposed to? I mean, don't you think that if we accept the proposition that some sophisticated readers may miss it, don't you think that overall the reasonable readers are going to decide that this is satire?
Not in this instance, Your Honor. It's not like the Jerry Falwell case, you may remember, where Jerry Falwell was defamed by Larry Flynt saying that he had sex with his mother in an outhouse. Okay, that you can tell is satire. If you read what's written here, this is incredibly dry, it's incredibly commercial, it's incredibly competitive. And Esquire itself recognized that, and 2.5 hours after this thing was published said, for those of you that don't understand that this was satire, it was really satire. They admitted that it was being taken not as satire, but as reality.
Well, you don't want to count that aspect of the update against them, do you? Is that fair?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
You don't want to count the aspect of the update that makes it clear that it's satire against them, right? You presumably want to encourage publishers to make call correction. It's only a correction if we assume that the a certain number of people who got it wrong.
If this was done in good faith, Your Honor, you would be right. But it was not done in good faith. It was cleverly done to harm WorldNet Daily Books. They suffered a great deal of loss of sales, of reputation. We even had the author, Warren, tell the Daily Caller, and this was published, that Mr. Corsi was an execrable piece of you-know-what. I don't want to use that word in this courtroom. And that, in fact, he had no regrets about publishing it. The malice is there. But you don't even need malice, because here you have libel per se. This is defamation in the context of your trade and profession. And what Joseph Farah, WorldNet Daily Books, and Corsi were being accused of was committing a fraud. That, in fact, this book was not accurate. In fact, that was stated in the statement published by Esquire. In effect, committing a crime. That's libel per se. So, as a matter of law, this case should have proceeded.
You made some pretty strong leaps. I mean, the update unquestionably asserts that the book tells lies. But that's different from fraud.
It's a fraud if you get someone to purchase a book with the expectation that what's being in that book is true, and in fact it's not true, and you're not advising the reader. So consequently, we would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that what Esquire was saying is that a fraud was committed. What's important here is, and I want to make this point, is that you don't even need to reach the D.C. slap statute here, is that we have demonstrated, and we had a right to prove it, not to have our rights cut off before even discovery, before even going to perhaps a preliminary injunction hearing or trial, we show the likelihood of success on the merits. And consequently, this case should have proceeded. Let it all come out in the wash. Let the judge decide after we have an opportunity to take discovery where we stand. But clearly, this was a commercial competitor. Esquire admits this at the end of its disclaimer. It says, don't read WorldNet Daily. Read what we have to say because we're telling you the truth. They're competing. And one's competing with one concept and others competing with another concept. This is not a matter of public interest. We never, ever addressed, in terms of our legal proceedings, whether President Obama's born here or not. But it's their right to say it under the First Amendment. And it's their right to compete with Esquire to say it. And it's their right to say it without having them misrepresented and misquoted when they're not, in fact, making those quotes.
I assume that you would agree that if this rises to the level of satire or maybe descends, I don't know, but that if it was satirical, it would be protected by the First Amendment.
If it was satirical, but it's not satirical. And in fact, Mr. Farah made a statement himself off the cuff that this was poorly executed parody, meaning it wasn't parody at all.
Well, that's one way to view what he said.
But that's not for the trier of fact to decide at this stage.
Well, we have an in-bank case that says that the defendant's publication must be taken as a whole and in the sense in which it would be understood by the readers to whom it was addressed. So in the record in the district court, the defendants have multiple exhibits of the communications that have been going back and forth on the issue of the president's place of birth. That is the context, is it not, in which the publication that you're challenging is to be addressed.
Your Honor, let me read you what Judge Wilkins found in a similar case, 3M. It deals with this.
I want you to focus on the record in this case.
Absolutely.
Given what our in-bank court has said we are to focus on.
Those documents, Your Honor, were never authenticated. They were put in the record as internet publications.
Did you challenge them as fakes or unauthenticated or anything? I don't see that in the record.
Well, we challenged them in the context of their not being truthful. We challenged them in the context
They were submitted as an indication of the discussion that had been going on about this issue, as a way of putting in context the statements you're challenging.
We did challenge them, Your Honor. We did. And let me explain why we challenged them.
Where did you challenge that all of the defendants' exhibits were, you say unauthenticated, but that were fakes, in other words?
Well, number one, Your Honor, we refuted what was said in our briefs in the lower court.
No, you refute the truth, all right, in terms of the president's place of
birth.
But you don't refute, as I understand it, that these communications were actually available to the public.
I'm trying to answer your question, Your Honor, and I think it's a good question. But I respectfully submit that it's not relevant to the proceeding, and let me tell you why.
Okay, but let me ask you this. Bear with me, and first answer the question, and then you can tell me why it's not relevant.
Okay. It was our understanding, the way we were refuting this, to say that you have to take what's in the complaint as true. This was a 12B6 motion. You don't go beyond the complaint to discuss things that are outside of the record. That is what we said in our briefs. And number two, as Judge Wilkins said, when he found that Rule 9 and Rule 12B6, because it does decide the issues of whether SLAPP would be available here, I'm going to quote Judge Wilkins, because we were going by his guidance here. But a federal court may not dismiss a case without a trial based upon its view of the merits of the case after considering matters outside of the pleadings, except in those instances where summary judgment under Rule 56 is appropriate. We did not have summary judgment here. It was Rule 12B6. So they dumped this into the record to try to prejudice the lower court. It was not relevant. It had nothing to do with the 12B6, and the judge shouldn't have considered it. And, in fact, the judge showed a bias in this case because she made a ruling that President Obama was born in the United States. That wasn't even the issue. And then, in a pejorative way, referred to our clients as birthers. That's a pejorative term. She had a certain mindset, and we're asking that when this case is remanded, that this court order that it be assigned to another judge, because what she did was blatantly illegal by the findings specifically of one of her colleagues, Judge Wilkins, who was just simply following the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. This is a simple case, Your Honor. It should proceed. Whether or not there was defamation, false light, whether or not there was invasion of privacy, which is the misuse of Mr. Farah's name in rendering a false quotation, whether or not there was tortious interference, whether or not there was a Lanham Act false advertising claim, should be decided after discovery on summary judgment. You don't pull away someone's rights without due process before giving them a chance. But in any event, on the face of it, if you just look at what was said, and I didn't want to take up your time by reading it, this is outrageous. You can't do this. It doesn't matter what your political views are. You deserve the right to sell your book, whether you're coming from the left, the right, the center, or anywhere else.
Would it have made any difference, do you think, if this had appeared in something like The Onion instead of Esquire's blog?
It wouldn't make no difference.
Okay. Even though The Onion, would The Onion be a competitor?
They're a competitor. You know, I myself have a website for my public interest group. I have people on the left, I'm a conservative, read that. And they comment on me every week, sometimes very outrageously, I might add. People read both sides. I watch MSNBC because I want to know what the other side is saying. They read both. So, yes, they're competitors. And this was commercial. It was not in the public interest. This was not a debate over whether the president was born here. This was a debate whether this book was inaccurate, whether this book was, in fact, defrauding the public, in fact, committing a crime. And although we can show malice, particularly with the comment about inexorable piece of you-know-what, that shows it all. And I have no regrets. That's what Warren said when called by the Daily Caller for a comment. This case must proceed, even if there was malice. So we thank you very much. I don't know if I have any time remaining on rebuttal.
We'll give you a
minute. I would very much like to address what my esteemed opponent has to say.
We'll give you a minute. Let's
thank you very much.
Counsel for appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I won't dwell on this, but I think it needs to be said at the outset that the notion that Esquire magazine and WorldNet Daily are commercial competitors is patently absurd. And the fact that the plaintiffs here claim that this somehow has to do with commercial interests just doesn't make any sense, is completely implausible just on the face of things. Two things quickly. If this was really about trying to harm the publisher's interests, there's no way that an update would have been published within 90 minutes making express the fact that this was satire, and in effect saying in an express way exactly what the satiric article said, providing commentary attacking the plaintiffs in this particular case. And the fact that plaintiffs claimed that they had such substantial commercial injuries over a 90-minute period, and that's what they are alleging here, that they sustained this devastating commercial harm over a 90-minute period is also completely implausible, especially when you take into account that the plaintiffs, who have their own website, who have their own book publishing arm, and were out in the media responding to this immediately, within 2 hours of the original post, somehow suffered this commercial harm is just completely implausible. What this case is about and what this speech is about, it's about debate. It's about political debate. This is core political speech. It was a commentary on those who claim that the President of the United States was not eligible for office. And as they allege in their own complaint and in their papers, they were the go-to source for that side of the debate. They had continuous coverage on it and consider themselves to be world-renowned in terms of their views on this issue.
I noticed in the passage in your brief on the update, you never discussed the assertion that the plaintiffs, people who became the plaintiffs here, were doing it to deceive their gullible supporters and make money. What First Amendment principles protect you on that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, the update says, not really, that there are people who are emerged here as plaintiffs or liars, but also that they're lying entirely to make money, to deceive their gullible followers and to make money, to sell books to people who, by hypothesis, are too stupid to figure out that they're liars. And what is the First Amendment principle that protects that statement?
Well, Your Honor, that's I think, well within the sphere of political commentary. It is a comment that one may be acting in their own self-interest instead of truly advocating a position on debate and raising questions about that. In this particular case, as soon as Esquire had published its blog piece, the plaintiffs had gone out and started to solicit funds on their website in order to buy Esquire and put it out of business. So certainly there are...
What does that show? That shows they tried to make a move in defense against this attack. So, big deal.
Well, you're right. Your Honor, commentary suggesting that people are acting in their own commercial self-interest while speaking out in a political topic is certainly a topic that's in newspapers day after day, where people question the interests that those are the participants in public debate are actually pursuing. The commentary, that express commentary, is principally, though, an attack on their position, saying that it is outright absurd. And the satire, which Mr. Klayman admits, if it is satire, it's protected by the First Amendment and is dispositive of this entire issue now, that satire was also clear. This was classic satire. And not only are we dealing with political speech, which is at the top of the rung in terms of the hierarchy of First Amendment values, but we're talking about classic satire, which the Supreme Court has specifically recognized as deserving of special protection. In the Falwell case and in the Milkovich case, which plaintiffs cite also, in recounting the history of protection, the Supreme Court speaks specifically to the type of speech, rhetorical hyperbole, and the sort of imaginative expression which enlivens and enriches public discourse. And that's precisely what this was. And the genre of satire, of realistic satire specifically, is designed to fool readers. This is a mode of discourse that's been part of Western civilization since the dawn of it. And it's,
how do you fit together the legally stated test of what a reasonable reader would think was involved with the proposition that you assert a few pages later in your brief that good satire often tricks even very sophisticated readers?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that goes directly to the Falwell, Bressler, and letter carriers line where the court is particularly focused on the fact that this mode of discourse, creative expression, needs to be given, and satire specifically, needs to be given an extra level of protection. And the Tenth Circuit in the Pring case, which deals specifically with satire, links this back to the reasonable reader inquiry. And they say that that is a constitutional inquiry that is informed by those particular cases. That you can't take the sort of literal approach that's advocated here. If that sort of literal approach had been taken in the Falwell case, the Campari ad would have been actionable.
Yeah, it is Falwell. Hustler.
Yes.
There they had a jury finding that a reasonable reader would not regard the assertions as assertions of fact. And here, Clayman wants to get to the jury. We don't have a jury. So I take it we have to say that no reasonable jury could find that a reasonable reader would regard these as assertions of fact.
That's right, Your Honor.
Two layers of reasonableness that have to be fitted into the process.
That's right, Your Honor. And on the face of the blog post itself, I think that you can easily reach that judgment.
Who do you think is the reasonable reader here?
The reasonable reader, Your Honor, is someone the case law tells us of learning, and somebody who's going to be familiar with the circumstances. And as Judge Rogers said, somebody who reads this in context. The reader who came to this blog is somebody who is familiar with Esquire, is familiar with the tongue-in-cheek approach of Esquire, or perhaps somebody who went on to the internet and put in a search of the birthers and is going to be familiar with that movement. And the principal thing there is the adamance, the unyielding stance that was taken in the face of all evidence to the contrary, that President Obama was ineligible to hold office. This book was published 3 weeks after the release of the long-form birth certificate, and the blog post was published a day later. Within that context, these readers knew that the plaintiffs would never take the actions that are attributed to them in the blog. It was simply implausible. The publication of a book is a very deliberate exercise, and to reverse course the day afterwards, while you hadn't done so in the intervening 3 weeks since the release of the birth certificate, is simply improbable. So the core premise of the satire was to turn plaintiffs' public position, very public position, on its head. And there were also other clues embedded into the satiric blog as well, including principally the humor tag at the end, which plaintiffs have acknowledged might very well be dispositive of this case. It makes what might otherwise be a close case into a very easy case. There are also other hallmarks of satire in here as well, the coarse language that's used.
You're talking about the word humor at the end of the list of tags on page 256.
That's right, Your Honor. And this gets...
It's very fine print.
It is. Well, and at least in my version of this, all of it is very fine print. The print is basically the same size as the rest. But when undertaking the reasonable reader standard, and throughout this inquiry, one has to look at the article as a whole. One has to look at the blog post as a whole.
It seems to me that there is some information in the record that says, at least when Mr. Farrow was interviewed, I guess the day of this incident, he says that, in fact, he had received calls from top editors at all of the big news agencies around the country asking him if this was true. Would you consider them to be the kind of learned people who would be reasonable readers?
I work with journalists, Your Honor, and they're always asking questions, so that it doesn't surprise me that they would be calling and seeking comment on that. But the fact that the New Times case makes clear that the fact that some readers may have not have gotten it right away or may not have gotten it at all is not dispositive of the inquiry. And the clues are there embedded in it. There are also the quotes which are improbable that they would use, that they wanted to erase Obama's memory. These are the sorts of quotes that are typically found in classic satire. There's a false book title showing a fascination with conspiracy theory about the moon landing cover-up. Again, all of these, the cumulative effect of them, would lead a reasonable reader to conclude that this is satire. Your Honor, at the end of the day, this is a highly political blog. It was on a highly controversial subject, and it was hotly debated. It belongs in the realm of public debate. Both sides are media, and both sides had their say on the controversy. This is precisely the sort of controversy that belongs in the realm of public opinion and public debate, not in the courts. This court has said repeatedly, placed an emphasis on the use of summary procedures in cases involving core political speech, protected First Amendment expression. This is such a case. The consequences otherwise would be too great. It would cast doubt on the protection that would be afforded.
So let me ask you in response to Appellant's counsel's statement, since this is 12b-6, as I understood his response, the court is not entitled to look at the exhibits to which you attached to your motion in the district court.
Your Honor, this is also an anti-SLAPP motion. It was dismissed on both grounds. But even under 12b-6, those articles are properly subject of judicial notice. The Washington Post v. Robinson case, which we cited, is one citation to support that in this circuit, which deals with newspaper articles. This is a matter of public record. It's plaintiff's own blog posts, and they never questioned them in the district court. But even if it was just on the face of the blog post itself, and the surrounding context, which is clearly a subject of judicial notice, it's historical fact, the controversy over the birther, and their adamance in this position, that is enough in order to dismiss this under 12b-6 and affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is not a case about controversy over birthers or where President Obama was born. It's about marketing your book. They have a right to say what they want. We have a right to say what my clients want. But just listen to the first phrase of this so-called disclaimer. And I might add that the article initially was published as breaking news with a siren. Breaking news, not satire. Said nothing about satire. And in fact, the article is still up on the internet to this day, causing additional harm. But just listen to the first
Would the reasonable reader know what the siren was?
Well, it shows that it's important. Breaking news. It's happening quickly. And everything happened quickly here. But listen to this first part of the disclaimer, because it says it all. Update, 12:25 p.m. For those who didn't figure it out, an admission by Esquire and Warren that there was a misreading in their mind of what happened. But there was no misreading because the calls came. Cancel the book, give back the money. That caused commercial harm, and it's continuing to.
But if a few misreadings disprove kind of a satire, then it's almost never going to be useful as a defense, right?
And Your Honor raised, I agree with you in another case, but not in this case, Your Honor, because you raised some very good points. Is that in this case, we're not talking about Jerry Falwell and mothers in outhouses having sex, excuse the language. We're talking about hard reality here. Just read what was written. This was completely believable. And they made the point. Esquire made the point. The president had released his birth certificate, so he claimed, on the White House website 2 weeks earlier. So this was hard fact that was being reported, and that's the way it was taken. But in any event, it is a 12b-6 motion. You do not go outside the pleadings, and we had the right, even though we've made a prima facie showing of likelihood of success on the merits, we had the right to take discovery. Only God knows what's contained in Esquire's files. Perhaps there are documents which say we're going to harm Joseph Farah and Jerome Corsi and Wilma Daily Books, and this is how we're going to do it, because we hate their guts. because they're politically at odds with us and we're going to destroy them. We have a right to find that information.
If the defendants are right on what the reasonable reader would find, that's irrelevant, right?
No, I mean, what I'm saying is that on its face, this case should proceed the way it is now. It was a 12B6. But if the case went to discovery, which it should have, you'll probably find emails, memoranda, and notes showing the animus and intent and design of Esquire to do what it did. And I might add one last thing. You know, Esquire, this reporter is very political. But Esquire, you read it, men read it, and other people read it, and they're not political necessarily. In fact, they read it for fashion, they read it for health, they read it for design, they read it for other things. So consequently, there is an overlap in readership between a generally conservative libertarian readership and what may be perceived to be, as they argued, a leftist readership. Esquire is not a political magazine. It's a men's magazine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the case under advisement.